You know, I wanted to, like, people who didn't support us year one, I wanted to say to them, you pay us double now, you want to come. You know, we told you this would work.
One of the biggest events in the pop culture scene worldwide is a convention based out of California, officially the San Diego Comic Convention International. It was established in the 70s and is the premier event for new and existing shows, for fans to interact with stars and with each other, and also where publishers and producers share some of the big announcements for the year. Now, in the late 2000s, halfway across the world, a young man couldn't understand why the Middle East didn't have one of these mega events for the aficionados of comic books and pop culture here. And since Dubai was home for him, he couldn't help but link his passion for comics to his location here in the UAE.
I came to Dubai. I turned 3 in Dubai, which was in 1980. Now I've given away my age. the family came down. Mom was in media. She was a journalist. Dad was in advertising.
Wow, it's like a perfect
blend
going on over there.
And that was it. You know, it was a family decision. I'm very grateful for that decision because it's... Gosh, it's going to be 40 years now, isn't it? Gosh, living here. And I'm very grateful for it.
From Amaya Media, I'm Chirag Desai, and you're listening to Tales of the Trade, a show about the UAE's entrepreneurs and pioneers and the stories not just behind their companies, but also the communities they brought to life.
I think from a very young age... I think I was a geek. I really was.
Considering where today's tale goes, that confession should come as no surprise. The kids of the 80s and 90s, myself included, grew up around a wave of comics and cartoons that spearheaded successive generations of TV and movies. Cartoons like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, one of my own favorites, Thundercats, found themselves on TV, and this was also the era that saw the release of the first Star Wars trilogy. But there was one cartoon in particular that I remember quite fondly, and it also had a massive impact on our guest today, Arafat Ali Khan.
I think He-Man is one of the first cartoon shows that had a movie that came out. I think it was He-Man She-Ra, Secret of the Sword. I still remember that. On Friday... it would be sleep-in day, but my eyes would open. I wouldn't set an alarm. Everyone would be asleep in the house. I would sneak, open the door quietly, sneak out, because our parents' room was right next to our room, so don't wake them up, you know, and sneak into the living room, get the video cassette out, put it in the VCR, low volume, sit right in front of the television and watch the movie again. And again and again. Yeah, it was just ingrained in me. And the other video cassette thing that I used to watch again and again, apart from, I mean, you know, you had the Disney stuff, and sure, of course, was the making of The Empire Strikes Back. Because my dad was in advertising, he was also quite interested in techniques of filmmaking and stuff. So he got that once because, you know, Star Wars was the big thing.
It was big at the time,
And I was fascinated. Not the movie itself. I love the movie, of course. Watched it millions of times even now. But the making of was something that enthralled me. To this day, I don't know what exactly, if you ask me why. Maybe because it had the miniatures, you know, so they were like, oh, you're making this movie out of action figures? There's the spaceships and, you know, the AT-ATs and the TIE fighters. I was just like, whoa. So yeah, those were the two things. So He-Man stuff. And the other thing in my wardrobe is way too many Star Wars t-shirts, shoes.
Now, just in case you don't believe him, Arafat wore a t-shirt that was a poster for He-Man and She-Ra, designed in the style of a poster from Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, to the interview.
Together we defend Castle Grayskull from the evil forces of Skeletor.
After graduating the opening batch of the American University of Dubai with a degree in marketing and advertising, Arafat found his way into public relations as a career. And by 2009, he joined on as a partner at the Extra Cake PR agency, where he served as director of public relations. And during one of those many discussions about how the Middle East deserved its own Comic-Con.
You know, even there's that epiphany moment where there's that click.
Like, I'll do it.
It literally was that. You know, why don't we? You know, it was that epiphany. And then, you know, it was all well and good, you know, to say something, right? And we were like, okay, let's research within the place where we live. How open are people to this? What opportunities are there to get exhibitors from this part of the world? Blah, 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 costs, all of that. I'll be honest with you, none of the feedback was very positive. You know, if you're an international massive brand, you're going to understand that this targets an audience that you cannot reach right now. There was no pop culture marketing. There was no concept of that. You know, so something targeted where you can talk to your perfect audience, hell yeah, you're going to be like, thank you, you know, let me kiss your hand. And things were like, you want to do a Comic-Con? No, 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 this is not our target audience. And, you know, as a marketing person, my jaw was on the floor wanting to say to this marketing manager, how the hell did you get your job, dude? Because this is exactly what you need, man. That happened a couple of times, and we were just like, what?
Although dejected by the initial response, they continued their research in the hope of finding a way forward for the convention. The closest pop culture events in the region were primarily licensing events, the kind where you pick up licenses for comics, artworks, and things to use for marketing.
I remember going to one licensing show. It was the usual, you know, people trying to have created these whatever, and they want to slap it on lunchboxes and whatever. And we were like, oh, yeah, more of the same. And then I spied at the end of this massive hall these two Emirati girls with this, like a very simple desk and, like, chairs, and they were just, like, scribbling or something. And I was like, this is really out of place. This is weird. What are they doing? Who are they? Went up there, and they were drawing. And they had these stack of books. There were two girls. And it was manga, manga style, you know, a comic book, really well done, like really well done. And I was like, this is amazing. Where can I buy this? Right. She was like, no, you know, there's no place to really sell these things. My dad, he knew a printing press. So he got a few printed at a cheap rate for friends and family. And that was the time where it was like, you know what? These guys deserve a platform. If these people exist, there must be others. There has to be others. And this was, I guess, the evolution of, okay, we're going to do a Comic-Con, huh? No. This was the evolution as we're going to create a platform for talent in the region where you can share to like-minded people, potentially publishers even, that look how talented I am. I'm as talented, if not more, than anywhere else in the world. And that was what really started driving us.
So in 2010, armed with this sense of purpose, plans began for the first Comic-Con to take place in Abu Dhabi the following year. Soon after, though, the region witnessed the Arab Spring, a series of revolutions and protests that began across countries in the larger MENA region. The team naturally felt that it wouldn't be right, in fact insensitive, to consider celebrating entertainment and pop culture when many were out on the streets trying to fight for theirs and their country's futures. So it wasn't until the immediate outcomes of the Arab Spring had started to take effect that they revisited the idea for a potential first edition in 2012, which also came with a change of city. A new venue, the Dubai International Marine Resort, based in Jumeirah, was now interested.
Which was really nice because they had an outdoor area and there was this sort of two-tier structure as well that could hold exhibitors and stuff. And we're not just going to, oh, how do you do Comic-Con States? Okay, let's bring that here. No, because it would not work. And our whole idea was, and this was, you know, one of the partners that had this idea, and I think it was brilliant, it's like, we'll make it a festival, not a traditional Comic-Con, because we want it to be accessible to everyone, which is the reason I think it worked. So the whole thing was, we had an outdoor stage, we had music, you know, we had food, drinks, you know. So come with your family. Okay, you don't want to look at exhibitors and comic books and what have you. All right, go outside, chill, have a drink, eat something.
I mean, it's a nice space
to
do that, right?
Yeah, so, you know. So that was the idea. We were very, very lucky with timing. They were very, you know, people say that, yeah, our business plan was perfect and everything. No, it wasn't perfect. We were business people trying to do something new that's never been done before. And we were geeks as well. So I think that was actually a good balance that we brought. Iron Man had come out in 2008.
Yeah.
And there was this massive resurgence of pop culture and superheroes and being more mainstream as well. So it was all kind of, you know, bubbling when we said, okay, let's do Comic-Con, right? I think Kina Kania had opened just recently and they had started a comic book section. That was, for a geek like me, that was like, oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm actually still very good friends with the person who was running the comic book section, a guy from Thailand who was working at Kania. He's still there, but he's now in Singapore and in a more senior position, and we're still really good friends. Because it was just like, wow, you know what we want, because he was a geek. He got it, you know, and he knew his business. It was a great mix, you know, similar. And there was, they got their material, their comic books, their trades, their toys and action figures from Diamond Distributors.
Diamond Comics is the leading distributor of comic books as well as related merchandise like toys, games, and apparel around the world. They hold the exclusive distribution agencies for most of the major comic book publishers, including Dark Horse Comics, DC, Image, IDW, Marvel Comics, and more.
And there was a gentleman who'd come down. He was the VP of sales who'd come down. And we had gotten introduced. So we sat with him. We talked to him. And, you know, passionate talking to him. And he really got behind us. And he started introducing us to publishers in the U.S., like Image Comics and Top Cow and all the, you know, oh, I know this person from Marvel. Hi, you know, here is Arafat. And that timing worked out so well. It was so perfect, honestly. If that hadn't happened, would we have been as successful? I don't know, actually, because, you know, we were cold calling, cold emailing people in the U.S. And so they would reach out to him going, who are these two jokers that have emailed us? Are they legit? And he would reply back saying, actually, I've met them. Right. They are legit. If you can, support them. And how amazing is that? That somebody who you've just met will back you. Like, this does not happen. Honestly, in this day and age, especially, people are very like, oh, I don't want to put my name to, you
behind
know,
somebody,
be
yeah.
backing these guys. I have hardly know them. So I'm so supremely grateful to the very first people that supported us, like Ku, like Index from Kina Kania, you know, and they were like, yeah, you know what? This is going to work. This is going to be big. So we had some of that. So we brought down some, you know, some of the publishers, come down, we'll pay for you. Obviously, they were like, what is this market, man? We don't know. Does anyone read our stuff?
Yeah.
And rightfully so. That was the right question. So we were like, we'll pay for you. We'll give you the booth. Come, please. It was our money at that time that had gone into this. Yes, of course, we were getting exhibitors. There were bits of money here and there. We were paying for celebrities to come down with credit cards. Because we
but
didn't.
You were paying that out of your pocket.
Yeah, it was the agency's money at the moment because we didn't have enough funding.
Not only were the finances looking precarious, but by January 2012, with just 3 months to go, they had yet to score a major sponsor.
I believe we made the calculation that, okay, we need to sell 8,300 something tickets so that we don't go under. Literally.
As an agency.
Okay. Literally, we were really putting our money where our mouths were with this because I think also we believed in it. It felt like people wanted it, even from the marketing, when people on social media, because thankfully social media was there to communicate with people. And people were like, what? You're doing this? Oh, my God. You know, all this. But of course, you know, everyone talks on social media. Anyway, so you're like, okay, let's do this.
The first Middle East film and comic convention was a two-day event held in 2012 on April 20 and 21. And outside of the financial hurdles, the looming questions of success, and an event the scale of which they had not really undertaken before, the roster was looking pretty solid.
I think year one, did we get Jason Momoa? We might have got Jason Momoa year one, which is maybe when he had just been killed off in Game of Thrones. Like,
spoiler
season
alert,
one.
Man. Like, why would you do this to people?
Oh, damn, man. If you haven't watched Game of Thrones yet, I think we got John Rhys-Davies, was Gimli in Lord of the Rings. A gem of a human being he was. And quite a few, you know, that were affordable. I mean, Jason Momoa now is skyrocketed, you know, in his career now, bless him. It was a good and a good roster. And, you know, we did this press conference where it was the panel of the guests and the two of us. And a lot of media had come down, a lot, because this was like, oh my gosh, we've got celebrities, all of these celebrities in one place. And this is something new. So the media was very supportive. Honestly, a lot of them got it. So the press conference was supposed to run 45 minutes max, as you know, press conference shouldn't run longer than 1.5 hours it ran. And we just wanted to get out because we didn't know what was happening front of house. The show had opened for an hour and we finally got out and we were like, you know, fast paced, wanting to get to the entrance to check the tickets. So because pre-sale tickets weren't that great, honestly. We were banking on ticket sales on the day.
Do you remember how many tickets you sold before, like the pre-sales?
Dude, it was... I don't even recall if it was like 1,000 or 2,000 even.
But do you think that was because there was some skepticism around the fact that it was the first one?
100%.
Should I put my money in advance if
and
I don't know?
The, what we've learned a lot as well, doing events for as long as we've done now in this part of the world, people are, when it's not like a concert, a Madonna concert or, you know, Metallica or something like that, they will usually see how they're feeling on the day. Do I want to go? Am I waking up and driving and going to this event? Honestly, sometimes I'm the same. I can't blame anyone, right? We're all the same, right? So this is the culture here. You know, it's not very much different to something in the US or Europe. Virgin, they were our ticketing partners, if I remember correctly. And with the 1,000 we'd sold, they were ecstatic. And we were like, what?
But your number was 8,000, so obviously for you it wasn't. Dude, we're nowhere close. Well,
yeah. And we couldn't understand. We were like, why are you guys so happy with this number? They were like, you don't understand. For events like this, we don't pre-sell these many tickets. This is unprecedented for us. So here we are hot-footing it to the entrance, and one of our colleagues comes pretty fast running towards us as well, and we're looking at each other going, oh. And he's like, have you heard? And... you know, inside, we were both like, we are screwed. We have to start looking for jobs. We were like, no, what? It's like there's a traffic jam on Beach Road, people trying to get into the event. And we were like, oh, okay.
That's a start.
We might actually do this. 12,000 tickets. So we exceeded our expectations. And for a first-year event...
That's a lot.
That's unbelievable.
That's
unbelievable. And, gosh, you know what? I get emotional, you know, whenever I talk about this. And what really did it for me was, you know, it was... Yeah, sure, you know, we'll make money in a few years. But what really did it for me, seeing all the happy people, you know, the sort of young people... And you could see it was almost like we can be ourselves finally. This is our home, you know? And just seeing that, I remember even like a few years later, some guy, like a visitor, he was like, you're one of the organizers, right? I was like, yes, how can I help? You know, what do you need? He's like, no, can I just hug you? And oh my God, I was almost in tears, man. Like, I'm almost in tears now just talking about it. And I was just like, sure? You know, I was like, what is going on, you know? And he was like, thank you so much for doing this for us. That's what made it all worthwhile, man, honestly.
You're not running the Comic-Con anymore.
No.
So what changed?
So... from a financial perspective, from the business perspective, there was some elements of monetary that selling the Comic-Con would help a lot. At the other time, we were still a boutique agency. We wanted this thing to grow. We can't we didn't maybe have what was needed at the time for it to be able to fly. So we were like, okay, let's see if we can get interested buyers. And there would only be a couple of some of the biggest event companies in the world that would be interested in something like this or could afford it.
We'll be right back. Stay with us. Hey, this is Chirag from Maya Media, and I wanted to tell you about our sponsors who help make this podcast possible. You're listening to the voices on this episode, courtesy of the recording studios at InFi Media in Production City. Thanks to the InFi membership program, which gives entrepreneurs, professionals, and students access to all of their creative workspaces and specialized facilities across three incubators, InFi Media, InFi Tech, and InFi Design, at very competitive annual fees. And as a member, you get access to their whole network of like-minded peers, over 100 mentors and investors, as well as over 200 events, workshops, and talks every year. And if you're a student, there's also a number of internship opportunities available to you. The place is here and your time is now. Visit infi.ae and sign up today. Our thanks to InFi for their support of this show and Amaya Media. Welcome back. I'm Chirag, and you're listening to Tales of the Trade from Amaya Media with Arafat Ali Khan. Having exceeded expectations in its first year, the Middle East Film and Comic Con was a viral hit. And heading into its second edition in 2013, the venue was now overflowing with attendees.
That two-tier structure at DIMC was not created to hold that many people. We had to stop people from going upstairs. We had to create a system where people would come down and then we let people up. It's not a problem you expect, but it's a good problem because you know there's a lot of people.
It's like going up the Burj Khalifa, right? Honestly,
it was that because we were scared that would collapse because there were too many people wanting to go. Anyway, so then we were like, okay, let's move to Trade Center. You know, bigger space was scary, more expensive, right? Because Trade Center, my lord.
The Dubai International Convention and Exhibition Center, located right by the Dubai World Trade Center, is the city's premier exhibition space, holding regional bigwig exhibitions such as Cityscape, Jitex, Gulf Food, the Arabian Travel Market, and a whole lot more. So moving to DWTC meant that Comic-Con was now officially part of Dubai's mainstream exhibition culture.
I believe that year we jumped to something like 40,000.
Was that just, okay, you'd been doing it for 2 years, there was enough awareness that you scaled up, or did you do something to like drive that?
Honestly, it was the people. It was coming from the people.
It was entirely organic.
It really was. It was the word of mouth. I mean, it's almost like unheard of, you know? We want more. We want more. Give us more. Give us bigger celebrities. Give us more content. And of course, from a business perspective, you have to do the numbers. You know, you'd be mad to just go in going, hey, you know, people are asking for it. Let's do it. No, of course. We believe, okay, more space, more opportunity for tickets sold. X equals, you know, and it was like, wow, this could mean some major, major revenues.
And by this time, sponsorships and stuff had started to...
Really,
was,
I mean,
set as well.
You know, I wanted to, like, people who didn't support us year one, I wanted to say to them, you pay us double now, you want to come. You know, we told you this would work, but no, obviously, it's not how it works. But yeah, people, you know, realized... Again, I'm not patting myself or any of the team's, you know, proverbial backs, but you've had businesses grow because of Comic-Con. And yeah, I think 2016 saw our biggest year. It was over 60,000 people. Yeah, we moved, I think, to a new section of Trade Center. I don't remember exactly. And yeah, you know, we hired, even though it's like I was a PR person, we had a PR agency as part of our company, we had to hire a PR agency because it was just getting too big. And we had other clients to fulfill as well, right? We can't just say, hey, sorry, 2 months, you won't get anything from us because we're working on our own event. You can't do that.
Obviously, you said you had hit about 60 plus by that point, and you sort of, you'd hit
it had saturated.
You felt like you hit a cap?
Yes. For us, it had saturated because the next year it was a little bit lower, right? So what needs to change? We're still creative. We're still doing fun stuff. Does it need an infusion of funds? Does it need an infusion of resources and manpower, both of which we were not able to do?
Was that an issue on the agency side, or was that an issue within the Comic-Con business line, so to speak?
Agency side.
Okay.
There had been financial difficulties, with no malice from the owner side. It's just not investing in the best ways. The thought process was going a little bit in different directions. And then how it ended out is, okay, you know, this wouldn't be a bad thing for this side of the agency to maybe continue or split off or whatever it is.
The list of potential buyers wasn't very long, really. And in 2017, the Middle East Comic Con was sold to Informa, an events company handling over 500 events worldwide, with a large local presence behind some of the region's major events, such as Cityscape and the newly launched OnDXP in 2019. With the parent PR company also not in great shape to continue, and the baby he'd nurtured for 4 years now being managed by someone else, where did Arafat fit in all of this?
I don't know if it's, you know, when you have been doing something for so long, and I'm not saying this is a good thing or a bad thing, but you're kind of slightly set in your ways in how you would want to see it done. And that's not necessarily the viewpoint of the company that is running it. Again, for not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing, right? They have a certain viewpoint of, okay, if this event is going to succeed, this is what needs to be done. They're a huge company. They do events. Chances are they might be right, yeah. Right? But regardless of whether they're right or not,
it's not what you want.
It's not what I wanted. You know, it was a much bigger company that was now that now owned Comic-Con, really. And, you know, different way of doing things and, you know, putting in resources and things. And it kind of almost was like, okay, well, we're selling this. This person's getting a bit of money. This person's getting this. They want to do other things. Okay, let's do that. And kind of that was the end of that.
Tell me what it was like those couple of years just dealing with that.
2017 was really tough. It was end of 2017, beginning of 2018. I was lost. What do I do? Well, who am I? Honestly, my identity was almost, you know, people would jokingly call me Mr. Comic-Con, right?
Because you were the public face of this and something that was
huge.
Yeah.
Also, Informa was really awesome in the sense that even with, you know, when they were running it full force in 2018, they said, oh, can you do the opening press conference and lead it with our, you know, our team? And I was just like, oh, thank you. That's really, you know, really great. I mean, one, also, it made sense because I was so geeky and they were so busy with other stuff that I could talk and be articulate about that genre while they're, you know. So I really appreciated that from their side, that they invited me back, even though they had really, at that stage, you could say I had nothing to do with it anymore. It was their choice to say, hey, Arafat, can you work with us for this con and help us with X, Y, and Z? It was almost like a nice segue or transition or closure. You know, to say, okay, well, you know, I'm almost like I'm doing this kind of a handoff, but I'm still here, you know, with Comic-Con. For me, that was nice, that sort of beginning of 2018 was, I think, the step in the right direction. And I'm grateful for them as well. I think they sort of supported me in making the decisions I did.
And at a time where Informa was buying Comic-Con, there were a lot of rumors floating all over the place as to why that would have happened. And that's, I think, one of the downsides that come with being this sort of public face. I think a lot of it may have been targeted at you rather than at the team, right? Or at Comic-Con as a whole.
You know, yes, you're right. And it's, again, very interesting. And this is why I say also that I am very grateful and blessed that when these things would come to me, people would start the conversation with, Arafat, I know it's not you, but I've heard this, this, and this. Can you give us some clarity? What's going on? What the hell, man? You know, all sorts of different styles, right? And again, I think I in everything that I have done, I continue to do, I try and lead with integrity if I can. You know, when I say from the heart, I mean I'm being true to myself and to others. And it does show, I feel. So it was heartbreaking when it came to me and like, you heard what? No, man, come on. Or, you know, trying to be also and also not A, wanting to lie, or B, not also being able to say as much as I could during that period because it's not public knowledge, right? And it can't be public knowledge as these big acquisitions happen. So, you know, trying to be as true, but also not being able to give a full representation of what is happening in the background. In some cases, not needing to also. Everyone doesn't need to know everything.
I think today is on social media, people will vehemently disagree with
that. Yeah. You know, so just trying to be as principled as possible when answering and not being an outright liar or being or making up a story that doesn't exist to placate people, but just trying to give as much of the truth that was there that and say, okay, that's the close of the story.
This is what I can say, and that's it.
Correct.
By the time 2018 rolled around, Arafat found his original calling still intact. And while Comic-Con was one way to deliver on that vision of integrating pop culture and entertainment, he started a new project.
2018, I decided, okay, you know, I'm going to start my own marketing consultancy that supports other companies developing pop culture events or integrating it into your marketing. What I want to do is I want to help those companies, whoever they may be, large or small, keep that integrity in the sense that, okay, you want to infuse this into what you're doing. Let's do it right. Let's do it with that passion, with that knowledge, right? Let's do this. I have knowledge and contacts that no one else has. People are going to be knocking down my door, just like we thought for Comic-Con, right? Like 8 years or 9 years previous. Yeah, it wasn't the case. It was almost like, yeah, okay, let's knock on those doors again. Let's get myself out there again. Okay, this is what I'm doing now. Oh, Arafat, this is what you're doing now. Oh, okay, this is interesting. But then nothing happens. And then it took... Again, that even though, you know, like people know me, people know what I've accomplished and, you know, what I can add, let's say, to their business, you don't necessarily have the money to come and say, hey, Arafat, you know, I want to do this. I have this other extra consultancy fee. That's usually not the case, right? So it took a lot of, you know, doing small things, really, like... these quizzes, I was like, you know what, let's get my face back out there. You know, Arafat and, you know, a couple of people are still in pop culture. They're still working for the community, trying to develop and build the community. I mean, I was doing these quiz things for 500 dirhams, man. It wasn't a matter of money, you know, and I genuinely enjoyed it because half the people who would come, more than half to these quizzes, were friends, you know, people who I've develop relationships with over the years, you know, or acquaintances. So it would be a fun experience. We'd have, you know, people I wouldn't necessarily see on a regular basis. It's almost like a get-together, a geek get-together that we would create for these things. And, you know, I have other ideas that are brewing as well for other pop culture activations, let's just say, that I'm hoping will come to fruition and, you know, do a little bit more. But it's been a great year in terms of work so far. It's been wonderful. I've had an opportunity to work with some great projects, actually, including Comic-Con. You know, I still booked the artists at the comic book artists and writers this year, and that's where my heart really is. You know, I'm a comic book geek at heart, so that was fun. That was nice.
In creating all of this, do you feel like an entrepreneur now, or did you feel like an entrepreneur throughout, like when you did this?
I feel like one now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I know we were doing something that was new, something groundbreaking. But at the end of the day, as an agency, yes, I had a share, but I was an employee, right? You know, even though, quote, unquote, I'm a partner in MEFCC, and I'm a co-founder, at the end of the day, I was getting a salary, I was. A bonus here and then, if Comic-Con did well, sure. Which, you know, made it all worthwhile, of course, whatever. But now, if I decide to, okay, I'm not going to work today, there's no one else that's there saying, okay, I'll get this done. No, you know, it has to be like, okay, you know, like, yes, there is a, you know, we're a couple of partners. Anyone else who comes on board is a project consultant because we need them, you know, and we do get them. But at the end of the day, it's, okay, please come on board. We need your support and we will pay you. But it's being led from here, from me, right? So even though, yes, we were shaping and developing and there were times where you would not get your salary if things didn't work. I mean, when I set up the PR agency, it was all based on what business I was getting, sure. But at the end of the day, as I keep on saying, quote unquote, it was as an employee, even though I was building it. But right now it is, okay, so the company is in your name. All right, what's your visa? Oh, it's a partner visa. Okay, it's your company. Right, you know, it's all of this. It's all on you. That's why, I mean, it took a while, honestly, that even after opening the company, I was still a little bit lost on exactly how or where. And there were those times where it was like, is this me? Is this right for me? Is this what I really want to continue and do? Wouldn't it be easier just to get a job? Wouldn't it be easier? You have some great contacts. Pick up the phone. Maybe move countries. Who knows what's in store, you know? Maybe somebody will offer you a job somewhere else. But the more I've done it, especially over this year, the more I'm loving it. And this has always been my analogy, even when I was doing doing MEFCC or any other owned events that were being run by us. It's like being on a roller coaster. So while you're on it, you're like, holy shit, get me off of this. Oh my God, it's insane. Oh my God. And then you get off the roller coaster. You're like, damn, that was fun, man. Let's do that again.
The 2020 edition of the Middle East Film and Comic Con runs through the weekend of March 3rd at the Dubai International Exhibition and Convention Center. We also have a special bonus episode with Arafat that will be out next week, so you can stay tuned for that. This episode of Tales of the Trade was produced by me, Chirag Desai, with support from Abhishek Venkatasubramanian, Sukina Kazmi, and Zainab Bujaini. If you've enjoyed this episode, we'd love if you shared it and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also drop us a note on Instagram at talesofthe.trade. Tales of the Trade is part of the Ameya Media Network. You can find out more at ameya.media and subscribe to all of our episodes for free in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Angami. We'll see you next week.